Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today, our guest has 15 years of law enforcement analysis experience, with over a decade of experience as a crime analyst supervisor. He is a founding member and current president of the New York Association of Law Enforcement Analysts. He is a New York State certified crime analyst representing the great city of Albany. Please welcome Matthew Zakharowicz. Matthew, how are we doing?
We're doing fantastic. Thank you so much, Jason. And I'd like to give you a little kudos as well. You've been doing this podcast for over a year. You've been consistently posting every Monday. It's a phenomenal resource for people to latch onto. And with the catalog that you have, thumbing through the website to find all these great speakers on there, I'm just surprised I got on here as soon as I did. So I am very happy to be here. And congratulations again.
Oh, well, thank you. Not that we have to do a quid pro quo, but I wanted to thank you as well for reaching out to us and asking if you could be a part of the program. So thank you. And for the listeners, if you're listening to this and you want to be on the show, please email us at leapodcasts@gmail.com. All right, Matthew, let's get into it. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
I think it was actually in college when I was thumbing through a book at the library when they were talking about Jack Maple and his work in New York City in the transportation division, where they were analyzing trends. And I thought that that was unbelievably phenomenal. I was floored on the type of strategic approach that was being taken there and analyzing it. It seemed so different than what I saw on the TV show Cops. And I forgot about that for a while. I always knew that that was there, but never knew how to kind of crack into it. So I always wanted to be in the law enforcement career profession, but not necessarily police officer. I think that that's a common theme for a lot of people. So I did like community corrections, and I did get a job right out of college where we oversaw community service sentencing, where clients are mandated by courts to do community service. A part of that program was also a volunteer clearinghouse. So I reached out and saw, you know, and asked who accepts volunteers in the area that I could get more, you know, more experience in this large criminal justice system. And one of the volunteer opportunities was a victim's advocate. And a victim's advocate was somebody who was in the courtroom setting and was a go-between between a victim and the prosecutor. So the prosecutor, the assistant district attorney, is seeing a lot of different cases, and there's a victim sitting in the courtroom who might have a lot of questions. And this is somebody that can be a go-between between those two people. So I was working in the community service sentencing and volunteering as a courtroom advocate. One thing led to another where I ended up getting a position, a full-time position there in the victims advocacy program. We were filling out a lot of applications. I know this is a long story, but I'm going to get there.
It's okay. Keep on going. It's good.
We filled out a lot of applications for victims of crime to pay for their medical bills. And it dawned on me, it's like, we only see a very small amount of people that are in court because so many cases don't have arrests and we won't see these victims to offer our services. So it was suggested, all right, hey, that's a good idea. Why don't you do something? And I said, all right, I'll go down to the police department and I'll see if I can get my hands on police reports of people who were assaulted and we can reach out to them. As fate would have it, I ran into I would call her an analyst, but she was like a program manager. And she was from my previous job, community service sentencing. So here I am like, oh, what are you doing here? You know, just chit-chatting here in the police headquarters. And learning a little bit about her job. And the bottom line is, you know, she is an analyst without an analyst title. A couple months go by and she's like, you know, I'm leaving here. And so is my counterpart. the police department merged those two positions and then created something called a statistical unit supervisor position. So I was fortunate to apply for that job and get it. So that was my true first step into the profession as a statistical unit supervisor with no statistical unit. So I was ahead of the records department, and the statistics that they were talking about wasn't Z-scores or standard deviations. They were manual counting of reports for the uniform crime reporting.
So was there any analysts at the department at this time?
No, there was the statistical counting of reports, which took about 3 weeks out of the month to do. Mm-hmm. And there was a GIS coordinator that was using ArcView back at the time. And so for there was that 1 week out of the month that I was able to kind of have free rein about extracting data from the record management system. I went up to that GIS coordinator and said, hey, can you teach me how to map? I ended up being kind of like redundancy for him. So that way, if he went on vacation, I could do what he was doing. So there was a lot of opportunity to learn and grow. As you said, was there anybody else to learn from? There was a folder left on the desk that said next person. And inside it was all the different ways on how to extract data from the record management system, all the ways that were using SPSS to transform data from like penal law codes to UCR counts. So I was ever grateful for that person who left that folder behind. That was my entry into the police department.
Just for those listening, this is around 2004, 2005 that he's talking about. And so you come in as a supervisor. So how was that your first gig at a police department and you're a supervisor?
Yeah, I guess kind of lucky. I think they tacked on the supervisor role so that way they could bump up the pay a little bit. Sure. So that made it very, very appealing. The supervision was of the data entry staff, but they were kind of a hard nut to crack. And I was given a lot of support from sworn staff at the records department that I gave them a lot of credit, not just dump say, okay, you're doing all the UCR. They actually kept a lot of, they divvied up the work and divvied up the supervision of that staff. It was really hard. I mean, within the first couple of, let's say 6 months or a year, I was like, boy, I love this analysis stuff, but I'm just not doing enough of it. How can I do more? And within a short period of time, I made it to the Massachusetts Association of Crime Analysts, where I met, the people who I used to study to get the position, because it was written as a crime analyst position. And so there was Christopher Bruce's 10 commandments of being a crime analyst that I learned at the back of my hand and applied to my background and also the supervisory angle. I had interns at previous positions that I oversaw. And so that helped. But at the MACA conference was a great experience because, I would say it was like an asylum for crime analysts, because I got there. And as you're starting to talk to people, I would say, you had that same problem too, about, whatever problem I was having at the time, or telling people, hey, I have this problem. And they would say, I don't know exactly how to fix that problem, but I know you could talk to this person and you can use them as a sounding board. So it was just a great resource for me, who didn't really have any direct counterparts, but then to grow a network of people who've been doing it and feel the pain.
So you do this for a couple of years, and then in 2007, you become a crime analyst supervisor. So then does that mean they then hired some other crime analysts for you to supervise, or were you still over the data entry clerks?
There was a change, and they say that science progresses one funeral at a time. Well, policing and police departments progress one chief at a time. And those chiefs on average is what every 3 years there's going to be a change. So there was a new chief that came to town, and he wanted to modernize the department. This was right around the time that CompStat was really, really rolling. And we went away from uniform crime reporting of hand tallies, and we moved to IBR, which is all that it mattered to me was that I wasn't hand tallying stuff anymore. And that freed me up. And they the chief, again, wanted to take on a, you know, I almost said real time component, but it wasn't real time, but it was much more integrated into the detective and patrol work. So no longer was I going to be under administrative bureau. I was going to be under the detective bureau with a detective sergeant, two detectives. There was the GIS coordinator who ended up getting a GIS technician. As a crime analyst supervisor, I ended up with two crime analysts. So the new unit was called the Information Coordination Unit.
So I think your introduction into the profession is a unique one in that right out of school, you have exposure to victim advocacy, prosecution, and the community service sentencing. Looking back, how did this exposure shape who you became as an analyst?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's an interesting question. I guess I didn't take anything for granted. I knew that each stop I was making was contributing to, you know, my body of knowledge. For instance, when I hit Albany Police Department, I knew all the penal codes from number to, you know, description. So that was very easy for me to then, you know, apply that to the UCR code.
I would think too, that with your work with the victims and then coming in and doing the bean counting, if you will, you almost come in realizing that these aren't just numbers, that these are victims.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe I haven't really thought of that, or, you know, after the years, you do kind of forget about the impact that these crimes have. And now the way that the policing profession is going, and it does a lot of it come back to a trauma-based perspective of, you know, the tolls that happen in the communities when gun violence occurs. So, yeah, I was kind of intimately familiar with, you know, some of the names, and in courtroom setting, as you can imagine, there's a lot of domestic violence. Maybe half of what we were doing was domestic violence. But you know, the focus kind of shifts away from domestic violence and from a policing standpoint. Not to say, I mean, Albany Police Department had a dedicated detectives working domestic violence. It was a strong focus on domestic violence, but from a statistical perspective of UCR crime counts, you know, you look at the murders, the rapes, the robberies, the aggravated assaults, the burglaries, larcenies, motor vehicle thefts. You do sometimes lose that human element to it, but you sometimes can't lose fact of that these are still people's lives that are getting affected. And not all of them, or let's put it this way, a lot of them are innocent victims.
So then how was, you're starting this brand new unit, you're getting away from the bean counting into more analysis. What was some of the lessons learned or things that you think about during this time?
So a lot of it was trying to get to know first couple of weeks and the first couple of months is just kind of feeling everybody out. There's people, although I've been interacting with police officers at headquarters, they're different individuals than the real go-getters and street detectives that came in within this unit. So, you know, just to get to kind of know each other, feel each other out, I was pretty handy with computers and maybe necessarily they weren't. So just trying to lend a helping hand without taking over, intruding too much in what they needed to do. So there was a lot of quick wins that we had when it comes to some patterns that were being identified and creating the tactical crime pattern bulletins and back to the who, what, when, where, and why in identifying that information to get out to the people that can affect those crime patterns.
So I think you have a unique perspective considering that you came from records and then became an analyst. We always seem to be questioning data and how accurate police department data is. And when I had Deb Peel on, she was from NYPD doing the Comstat. That was really their first step, was to ensure the data was accurate. The whole mission of the data was to find patterns and to assign, get each pattern assigned a case number and work it through. I feel a lot of police departments don't spend enough time making sure the data is accurate. And it's often left to the middleman, the crime analyst, to do his or her best with what data is coming through. So I just wanted to get your perspective in terms of data quality, given your background.
Sure. And Deb Peel did a fantastic job giving her perspective on that. And I think I can give a perspective on a couple different sides. Tactical is one thing, but maybe from administrative analysis, it's kind of a little different. With administrative analysis, there's almost like two pots. There's centralized statistics, which really has to be accurate. And it has to be accurate because whatever goes into the system is going to go to the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services, onto the FBI, end up being foiled by the media or whoever, and then could come back and be scrutinized. So a lot of people think that it's sometimes easy to count homicides. Sometimes actually it isn't. It can be a little tricky because you could have somebody who is, you know, assaulted and then later they die. And when it's a centralized administrative function, well, who updates the record? You know, the record clerk just can't change the record. It has to go through maybe the officer who made the original report, not even, or maybe the detective who's investigating it. So sometimes there's a lot of steps that need to have a follow-up through in order for those statistics to maintain its accuracy. And so a crime analyst in my role was to make sure that all those things were kind of jiving together. Another side of the coin is what I would call administrative analysis, administrative statistics, but more decentralized, is where the analysts kind of hold on to the data and manage the data themselves. Think of shots fired. So shots fired, our record management system doesn't really do a good job of counting things that aren't penal law driven or UCR, IBR driven. So a shots fired database is something that can be maintained by the analyst. And we can determine whether or not once there was a shots fired and it ended up that shots fired was a shooting and there was two injuries. But as you read through the narrative, well, really one person was just burned by the gun as opposed to shot by a projectile. So that, you know, that was close eyes on the narrative, or back to a tactical perspective, speaking with the detectives and the police officers to get a better sense of what was going on in those circumstances to be able to determine whether or not exactly what occurred and what stat that incident should fall under. So that's kind of the difference between your administrative centralized, where you need a patrol supervisor overseeing the correct reports. I mean, unfortunately, sometimes we get cases that come in that are a homicide, but the attempted wasn't a yes. The attempted was no, which means it was committed, but it wasn't a homicide. It was just a attempted murder. Because most crimes are committed. So entering and attempted isn't really muscle memory, but supervision at the patrol is super important, and supervision at the analyst side for the decentralized statistics that they can hold on to and provide for command staff.
Yeah, so I think you're right. Certain records or fields in the records management system are going to be more scrutinized if they're going to the state or the FBI. Those fields for the bean counting might have some kind of validation process. I guess I'm more concerned about areas where the field is some kind of description of either a suspect or a vehicle or something pertinent to help solve the case or to link cases together. We get car descriptions, makes, models spelled 18 different ways because they're free form in the system and it's not uniformed. I guess that's my big concern there, is really getting to the descriptives that are going to link the cases together, and then also a narrative that's going to also help the analyst do their job and define patterns and trends.
Because I was actually thinking also in the other realm is like when you're mapping crime and there's three, we all know that there's inaccuracies in data. And if there was a bad address for a rape, but there were only three rapes on the map, even though there was 100 other crimes, we want to make sure that all those rapes are on the map. Mm-hmm. But I get your perspective for the tactical side and the investigative side. You're right. That information for me is much more fluid. It's much less what hits the report, because then you have to talk to the detective. Because if there was a scene, you know, a witness saw a vehicle fleeing the scene, that's really meaningless until you talk to somebody who talked to the victim. Because we can, as analysts, we can't talk to the victim 99% of the time. So we need to get a better sense, because I've been in situations where the detective would say, yeah, that guy, he was half blind in one eye and couldn't see out of the other. Not the reputation, but the legitimacy of that note that you thought could have been a lead could go south very quickly. But engaging the detectives and keeping abreast of the investigation can lead to, you know, other opportunities of or changing landscapes, because it is very fluid. So that's why reports are good for a very first blush of what the facts are. I remember a detective once saying that you could determine whether or not a burglary was committed by somebody who knows how to commit burglaries and do a lot of burglaries, because they would open the drawers from the bottom up, where if you open the drawers from the top down, you have to close the drawers to open up the next drawer. You're never going to find that in a report. So there's just so much stuff in reports, and those are official records that would then be brought through the procedural process to court if somebody were to get arrested. So I think sometimes less is more on reports. So again, the impetus is on the analyst to go ahead and use their resources to get as much information as possible.
Yeah. And there's definitely is a disconnect, because the patrol officer may be taking the initial report and then it gets handed off to the detective. That I think is crucial for the crime analyst to try to identify related cases. You're right. I mean, there's the detective's aspects to it, but some of that evidence can be gone by the time the investigator gets on the scene.
Yeah. In linking cases together, you have your generics, you have your, you know, your where, your when, you know, how did they go about doing it? Were there any signatures? What was stolen? What was targeted? You know, those are all super important, but it doesn't tell the whole story for sure. Linking some cases together, I remember that there were commonly when there is a delivery robbery series, it's a big deal. We didn't have any for like a year and a half. And then all of a sudden we started having several. So, you know, a lot of the signature items were the same. They were getting called to the outskirts of a certain neighborhood. You know, it was happening on the weekends and it was, you know, at a certain time. And so there was a lot of characteristics that were the same, but yet at the end, they were actually two different patterns. And they were just two different patterns that just popped out of nowhere. Yeah. And we could have bet that it was only one person that could be doing this, but in fact, it was two. So, you know, human behavior is a very funny thing. And it's, you know, pattern chasing is one of the most rewarding things to do. And, but sometimes it is difficult because there are can be a lot of missing holes.
Okay. And then you have a short stop here and then you move on to become the crime analyst supervisor with the Capital Region Crime Analysis Center. Talk about that transition.
Yeah, it's, you know, a stop, I guess, is still a decent word. It's just moving the desk, you know, in a sense. So I went from the first floor of headquarters and records to the second floor of headquarters to across the hallway of the detective's office downtown. And the state, who the Division of Criminal Justice Services, has been already creating an environment for analysis to flourish. And there's always been a lot of support, whether it be training support or financial support and software to build this out. As a byproduct of one of these programs, they wanted to put a crime analysis center into the four largest areas in upstate New York. So that ended up being Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, and Albany. So those four crime analysis centers got stood up, and Albany, they're all housed, or at least let's just be specific, I guess, to Albany. Albany is housed in the Albany Police Department, and it is a county. So it was at the initially Albany County Crime Analysis Center. It's kind of like a fusion or a task force style, where we still had the detective supervisor and the detectives and the crime analysts, but we had further support through adding another, I think it was four at the time, crime analysts. And then there was also a full-time state trooper. We had a great relationship with parole, part-time, probation, a HIDTA representative, and a sheriff as well. So there was a lot of support being given from the state to produce a countywide angle.
So there, you're creating the center again, right? You're creating the unit. So you're coming in, you're not replacing anybody. This is a brand new idea, and you're establishing the unit here.
Yes. Okay. And there was also a director that's a state employee to oversee that. So those are the two bosses, was the detective supervisor from Albany Police Department. That was the tactical side. And then more strategic side and building out the center was the director from the state.
What were some of the obstacles in the beginning?
You know, maybe just like anything, you know, just trying to get your feet wet and finding your own. There was a lot of questions of, what is the center really doing? What are they trying to do? We're the city of Albany, but we're also in Albany County. So when we call ourselves Albany Crime Analysis Center, they think, oh, well, you know, just probably Albany City because you're in Albany City. So, so there's always a little bit of wariness of a outside jurisdiction coming to Albany saying, hey, can you help us with our stuff? But what we did was we created one-to-one relationships. It's not like a hotline number that you can call and you don't know who you're going to get. And we're going to help you identify a suspect or get out a needs to be identified bulletin. We wanted to have a direct person-to-person relationship or analyst to detectives relationship. So that's really where once we got a few wins and we started building those relationships on the day-to-day, again, needs to be identified, shoplifting, you know, all the day-to-day crime, when something big or bigger happens, the muscle memory of picking up the phone and calling the crime analysis center just kind of, you know, was a part of that business.
Is this considered a real-time crime center at this time? Are you around the clock?
No, not at this time. It's still very far in its infancy stage. We then started taking on more responsibility. So Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, those are all much larger municipalities, where Albany, the city of Albany, has 100,000 people, but we're 15 minutes from two other urban areas. So it was going to be really natural that we were going to be a regional center. And so we ended up taking those three, you know, being those three counties, and then actually a fourth county, Saratoga County, to the north of us, with those added counties. And after we know our routine products, we also hired a real-time supervisor and had a real-time component.
How is dealing with the multi-jurisdiction aspect to this? Because you're coming in, you're creating the new unit, but now you have lots of folks from various departments coming together to establish this unit.
There was a lot of chances for opportunities to occur. There were, you know, the director and the real-time supervisor, they had a tight relationship with the detectives and created, you know, had information sharing meetings that hit the most sensitive patterns, where we knew that there was a regional approach needed and not just a small, you know, neighborhood involvement, but, you know, there was larger patterns occurring and getting the right people in the room and sharing that information across the meeting room floor made the biggest difference. And, you know, once you get some small wins, the momentum certainly continues.
And then from there, just last year, actually, you move on to the Office of Justice Research and Performance. So why did you make the move to this office?
Well, after being very fortunate to be in the position that I've been in over the past 15 years and create so at the ground floor of so many steps. And, you know, even the Crime Analysis Center network has grown to 10 centers and they're responsible for 31 counties. That's half in the state. So the exponential growth of the Crime Analysis Center networks has been great. There's a lot of opportunities that have come, but, you know, I'm not going to lie, you know, it was sometimes a little bit like Groundhog Day. You know, there was a lot of redundancy. I was ready for some new challenges.
What is your task like now?
My task now, so we can talk about, you know, what is crime analysis, and it's extremely varied, and the real-time component, they're really good at foraging and keeping relationships with detectives. My role was a little bit more technical with databases and Excel and Access and SPSS. So I continued with that path. Currently now I'm creating automated reports with Excel and Access and using VBA to do that. You know, VBA certainly wasn't my first choice, but that's what the office, you know, was using and is most familiar with. And if that's what the profession, not the profession, but if that's what the preferred software is and that's where the knowledge base is, then absolutely, I'm gonna learn that. I think that's one of the important parts about what a job entails. You know, what a job entails is kind of where you are at records department. You're gonna be doing very administrative analysis, media requests or monthly state requests or grant requests. Then once you start moving in, if the job is in the detective's office, well, you're going to be a lot more tactical and you're going to be a lot more responsive to, you know, the detective needs. So now I'm at the state, it's much more strategic in a sense too. It's not, you know, things that are due on a daily basis or a weekly basis. It's involving a lot of other departments because our stakeholders are other offices within the division. So it's definitely a change of pace, but I was definitely up for the challenge and learning new things as we go.
So these automated reports, they're going out to all the different offices across the state?
The specific team that I'm in is the community corrections team, and the state awards about $25 million to community groups to provide programming for those that are in the community and in need of resources. So as a response to getting grant funded, they have to give us data about the individuals that are in their programs. So we do a lot of analysis on that, as well as creating these routine reports of what does the demographics kind of look like within their programs and who's getting added to their programs. Is that within their expected clientele? What are the ages? What are the genders? That kind of thing.
And this is more of a technical question, and I'm really curious, when you're automating with VBA and Access and Excel, is it fully automated? And meaning that, okay, this will run on a schedule, it'll run this morning, whether you come to work or not, or is there still some behind the scenes that you have to push a couple buttons here and there to get it to work correctly?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's going to be still button heavy, but I guess when I say automated, we've probably shaved down, and this might not be straight work, but you know, what would take somebody 2 weeks to do? Probably a good 30 hours could be done in an hour. Nice. So we're certainly shaving a lot of time off of things. And then, you know, not only is it then just, you know, a number of hours, work hours, but it's also the consistency of the product. So that's where I feel that we made a lot of headway. It won't be 100% perfect because there's always going to be, you know, subtle changes within, you know, the period of which the reporting period time and for the fact that there's always some changes to the report here and there. For instance, we don't like the word sex anymore. We're going to change it to gender. Some simple updates that can be done and then be added into a routine at the very least.
Yeah, I would just, when you said that Excel access, I wasn't sure if it could be fully automated or not. It'd be nice if you get to the point where you're dealing with some kind of reporting services. You're running jobs off the network, off a data warehouse. You can just schedule those jobs and get everything done and out without hitting any buttons at all, right? I think that would be the ideal goal.
It certainly would be an ideal goal. I was actually talking to my counterpart kind of about that. I think, as I was talking about, you do where you are, when you're in records, whether you're in headquarters, whether you're in detectives, there's also the fourth other popular place that you could be in is that's in within IT. Mm-hmm. And when you're in the IT department, you're also exposed to very different ways of completing things. That might be having direct access to the back end, right?
Sure. It's funny, when I look back at my career, my first stop at a police department was in the research and development section, which was more administrative. And then I eventually moved to homicide unit to help them out specifically. But I was always had a desire for data management. And I always wanted to improve the process because there was just so much needed to be done with the data to get it to be in a better form to be analyzed that I always enjoyed that process of beginning to end, almost more than actually doing the analysis and solving the puzzle and trying to find a needle in the haystack. I've worked in various departments, worked in IT, and you're exactly right. If you're in IT, you just have a tendency to be doing more data management. But I think it's crucial for departments to have an analyst in the IT department. If in a perfect world, you would have one in IT, and then you would have one in districts and one in patrol and spread out. But obviously, a lot of jurisdictions, they'll be lucky to get one analyst, let alone several to spread out through the department. Because I think it's crucial to automate as much as possible, get past that button clicking that you have to do on a daily basis. And stuff should be automated and set the data definition once and it runs every day, regardless of you hitting buttons or not.
I completely agree. If there could be a little criticism of the state coming in and offering support through consultants to do stuff, the IT department at the police department is going to be very wary of giving the keys to the kingdom to outside consultant in a sense. Mm-hmm. And that investment of time of getting a new analyst, if the police department is going to hire a new analyst so that that way they can have somebody that they trust and that they will bring into the fold, it would have to come from the police department. And it isn't something that is probably so appealing. They would rather have another crime analyst at another shift, something that I guess it's just difficult to justify an expense that's more of a back-end support as opposed to, no, we need somebody up front that can do a lot of things that's going to help out a lot of people, even though the back-end support is going to make so much smoother for everybody else.
Yeah, it's a return on investment. So, and the same thing would be for software, right? If you're talking about getting a reporting services program in, that's extra money and that's automating behind the scenes, doing a lot of things that people don't really understand or know, but you're throwing a lot of money on the behind the curtain, so to speak, as opposed to front of the curtain.
Yeah, I mean, that was the beauty of access, right? Where it's something that's accessible. It's something that a lot of people know. It's free. You can do a lot of things with it. You can connect live data to it. You can build all different kinds of queries with it and reports. So sometimes there is a diminishing return of, let's say it doesn't have this bell or whistle and we could spend $20,000 on it and kind of rework the RMS, reconnect it through SQL, but we're going to need somebody to kind of manage that. Sometimes that return on investment just might not be worth that extra bell or whistle.
Just one more question regarding your position. So you started last year, May 2020. So how was switching jobs in the middle of the pandemic?
Oh, it was definitely different. I actually had come just back from Thailand on March 3rd, 2020. So my interview was March 4th. And they kind of wanted to do a remote interview, you know, coming from an international trip as this thing was kind of tipping off. So it already, it kind of felt a little funny. We did the remote, and then come, you know, I think the 17th of March, everything got locked down for coronavirus. And then I ended up getting hired April 30th. And my first day was in the office. I met one person who was my supervisor. I don't think I saw two other people in this large, I don't know, 16-story building. So it was a deserted island out there. And I hadn't been back in the office since. A lot of remote learning, but again, it was also new stuff for me to learn. And I was able to pick up a lot of training on just doing my own research. I think I'd still do missed out a little bit of being introduced to a lot of people in the office who I just met earlier this week for a retirement party. But with the technology, that there wasn't too much love lost in that connection of what job needs to get done and who's going to do the job and how we're going to do the job. And so I still feel, and everybody else is in support of, the job must continue. And I think we met all those expectations.
Yeah. So how was Thailand in February, March of last year? Were they in full counter COVID mode by then?
No, trying to think. It wasn't until, you know, there was certainly rumors. Mm-hmm. There was certainly discussions. We were actually going to go to Hong Kong and do a stopover there for a couple days. That was during their riots. So we decided not to do that. And they actually might have shut down because of COVID, even more importantly than the riots. So we didn't go through there. But probably about a couple of days before we left Thailand, there was discussions about shutting down schools. So it was knocking on their door. They didn't. Most of their cases that they had gotten were from like Chinese nationals coming over for tours and that kind of thing. So it didn't really blow up and was, organic over there at the time till a little bit later.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to get into your analyst badge stories, and I want to talk about the establishment of the New York Association for Law Enforcement Analysts. You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Kristen Lottman. My public service announcement is to say, get your face out of your phone and your fingers off your keyboard and make that face-to-face contact, because that's how you'll connect with other people.
Hi, this is Dawn Colossius. I just want you to know that when you hear or you think as an analyst, they don't know what they want us to do. Always remember, you don't have to wait. Show them, tell them, and be value added.
Welcome back, Matthew. I want to now get into your analyst badge stories. And for those that may be new to the show, the analyst badge story is the analyst career defining case or project. For you, you have three different stories for us today.
Yeah, I do. I talked a little bit about moving from the records department to the detectives in an information coordination unit capacity. And we had a detective supervisor there who, we had a pattern going on of burglaries and detective supervisor saying, you know, I know this guy's name is in our record management system. I know he's done it before. I know there's a good chance that he's had a secondhand transaction or has a warrant or has a recent arrest. And he's like, can you get me a list? And I'm like, sure, I can get you a list. So I got back to my desk. I'm like, he's going to ask for this again and again and again and again. So I created at the time called a known offender database. And the known offender database was all those that were arrested for burglary, robbery, theft from motor vehicles. And I think we ended up getting like gang members and gun offenses later on, and graffiti artists. So what that in Access, we have this table, and we just did a simple query of those individuals who were recently arrested. and those individuals who had a recent field interview card, those individuals who have an active warrant. We also brought in parole and probation data too, and link them in as well. So now we just don't have, oh, I think we know who this could be, down to, well, let's peruse some of these names. And this detective, the sergeant, knew these people like the back of his hand. He knew their MOs. So we ended up kind of enriching the database too of what their MOs are, because once you kind of have a signature, you kind of stick to it. That was an eye-opener to a detective sergeant who plugs data all day into a record management system, but rarely pulls it out. Or there's some drop-down menus that are already kind of like pre-fashioned and might not work for the particular request, but we can pull data out. We can create a structure that we can create this flagging system to get us further along in the investigation.
This is an access then. So how many records are we talking about in this table?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, you know, maybe in the beginning, we were talking about maybe like 5,000 people. We also created limits to say, all right, well, if they haven't been touched by a record management system in 4 years, we're going to drop that name from the database, because there were some individuals in the database that were deceased. Now, I didn't think that that was a problem, because a deceased person isn't going to get a field interview card or a recent arrest. So we won't see their name come out in the results. But, you know, I also understand that, you know, we want to have the database to be as fresh as possible. So the most important thing, I think, with that is I was able to take a question and apply, you know, technology to solve that problem. And it exceeded their expectations, and it kind of got the unit going in the right direction and kind of showcasing that technology.
Yeah, kudos for you for thinking ahead and saying, you know what, this isn't the last time I'm going to get the request. I better figure out a better way to do business.
Yeah.
And then your second story?
So the second story is a little bit different. You know, I'm here in the Northeast, and in upstate, we get a blizzard. You know, we call it a nor'easter, where we get like 12 inches or 16 inches of snow. And we let most of our staff go and go home early. And I'm sitting back and looking at the cameras. And there was always this one camera pointed at a contested corner store. And lo and behold, we have a shooting at that location. And in this middle of the snowstorm, the car that was involved that shot the individual in front of the store had fled. And we, you know, some detectives and police were on scene, but other detectives came into the crime analysis center to check the cameras. And, you know, we were able to kind of brainstorm, you know, kind of live of what's going on and what information we have and what other cameras that we could check. So we did the best that we could with looking at cameras to identify this car. The night real-time shift came in that evening and did more work with the cameras and caught a couple different angles of the car. And I'm kind of known at the time as a car guy in the office. You know, I'll tell you a little bit of the fact that I'm not really a car guy. I mean, I systematically look at things, and cars are just very easily to systematically look at. You know, you look at a sedan and you say, all right, is it American or is it foreign? It looks like a newer, it looks like a mid-2000s. You know, you can kind of, you know, use some deductive reasoning in that and pulling it apart. So that's what I did with this car, kind of got it nailed down to a, you know, make, model, year. And using stock photos, we pulled, we call it a lawman, but it's the DMV registration reports, and looked at the license plate readers and trying to further identify this car. We had a short list of whose car that could be. And it wasn't until a CDTA bus, a public transportation bus, went past it that had a camera on it, was able to read the license plate. And that was on the short list of the cars that we are looking at. And it set the investigation, you know, we weren't losing a step with the investigation, since we had done, you know, a lot of background on those, on that vehicle already.
That's not a license plate reader on the bus, right? That was just a camera. And then you were able to get the license plate off the video from the camera.
Correct. There was a little bit of interpretation of what the letters of the license plate could have been, but matching it up to the DMV registration, it was pretty sure fit. It was, I think, the first time I testified. Yep. It was the first time I testified. That was, I was glad I was able to get that underneath my belt.
So were you just watching the camera and all of a sudden you saw the shooting?
Unfortunately, I think I did lead in to say that, but no, that was not the case.
Okay. I was like, wow, that's lucky. So what did you have to testify on?
I testified on the car characteristics, you know, the physical characteristics of the car, coming up with the projected make, model, and year, and then doing the hops that I did to ultimately come back with the identity of the license plate, the registered owner, and then the operator.
All right. And was there much objection or questions from the defense?
No, I am a very visual person, especially when you're talking about cars, and we could highlight the certain, you know, C pillar of the car where, you know, the back windshield and the back window kind of come together and highlight some of those characteristics. So there was really no objection from the grand jury.
I got you. So what was the outcome of the case?
So we did get a conviction. It was a plea for 20 years. So.
Okay. Very good. All right. And then the last badge story?
The last badge story was chief request. So the chief collected a bunch of crime analysts and he sat us down. He had been taking a statistics course in his graduate coursework. And he said, we need to come up with a way to identify the next shooter. And I know you can do it. he elaborated a little bit of why that's important. And it's important because it needed to be systematic, needed to be defensible, and it needed to be objective. So with that, I mean, those were all valid reasons to put together an algorithm. And we took a look at about 5 years worth of data of those who were arrested for shooting or shots fired and went to see what was in their history. And that created a series of identifiers that they had in their history. And the more frequent they were in their history, the higher weight that we gave them. So we could apply this weight to any large number of group. I think we did it to maybe about 7,000 people. It would raise kind of the cream to the top of who are the most prolific people that are getting touched by the police department. Originally, it was historical. We knew then that we should probably apply like a 90-day activity. So that way we can see who's really active now. And one of the first postings that we put out, well, before we put the posting out, we compared that list against what detectives were thinking about of who is the most dangerous, who's the most active. And there was a lot of crossover, but we had a couple that weren't, you know, on their list, and they had a couple that weren't on our list. So that way we could kind of refine the system. But when the first list was posted, whether it be luck or by chance, one person on the list ended up getting shot, and that helped create some credibility for it.
So was this going back to a known offenders system in which, okay, we are going to identify those problem folks, and then when they come into a system, we're going to get prosecution involved to target them? Or is it more, because it sounded like there's a predictive element to say, okay, we can take this data and we can apply this to people that aren't on the list?
Yeah, it definitely was predictive in the sense of who should we focus our attention on to. I think one of the more important parts of it is that this was also picked up the state as a way to apply focused deterrence on individuals. But in the police department also did actually two ways. One was a punitive covert operations, and the other was a social side. So there was actually a track unit to reach and connect, and enhanced supervision unit. One was for juveniles and one was for adults. And those were those say, hey, listen, you know, knock on doors and say, we know that you're getting, you know, contacted by a police department. We know that you have a beef with somebody. What can we do to kind of get you out of this mess? So there was that two-prong approach by the Albany Police Department. It was called VOID, the Violent Offender Identification Directive. that was also something that we could bring up to the the prosecutors when there was an arrest to say, this isn't, you know, just somebody that got picked up off the street randomly. This is somebody that we need to have off the street because of a current beef or other circumstances.
Okay. Do you know how often folks took you up on the offer to get help and to helping them get out of their situation?
This is a good question. I would say that the enhanced supervision wasn't taken up too often because they were already 18, 19, 20 years old. They already had some difficulties and that was their kind of life. Although I think there was a mental health concern on one where they got touched up with some resources, but the to reach and connect was with the juveniles. And I think they had much better support on that side. Okay. And getting kids to the right resources.
Sure. Now, did you work on the algorithm?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Okay. So what all went into the algorithm? Was this just you or were you working with other folks with a mathematical background?
No, it was just us crime analysts. And mm-hmm. what we did is we researched every individual who was arrested for a shooting or a shots fired for the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. And we looked at to see what was in their history. And the more frequent it was in their history, the more weight we kind of gave it to them. And then if there was like a shooting in their history, well, even if it was just one, we would give that a high amount of weight. So some of the things that came out that we kind of didn't expect was, you know, certainly if they were on scenes of shots fired, you know, that was a high weight, but also unlawful possession of marijuana, or maybe we even didn't use that when we used criminal possession of marijuana, which was a higher threshold. Sure. That with the shots fired involvement would create a weight that would be high enough for them to be on the top of the list. And we would have a scoring system, that, especially if it occurred in the past 90 days, where they would be involved in a shots fired and had, you know, a marijuana arrest where they're not going to be incarcerated, you know, in the short term. So that would put a tight eye on those individuals. Okay. There was something else that you said about deterrence. I have to say that the deterrence factor is that once you turn an eye onto an individual that you know is involved deeply in crime, the more attention that you can give that individual or group of individuals, the more likely they are not to engage in that activity. Case in point, like I can count many, many instances where two feuding groups will call a truce because they don't want to get picked up by police officers with a gun, although they don't mind shooting at another person and getting arrested for it. You know, maybe it just comes back to the, you know, the psyche of, you know, yeah, gang members, and they would rather get the respect. They need to get the respect first. There's no respect in getting arrested for a gun, but there's respect maybe for shooting somebody and getting arrested. I think we would just rather not have the violence occur.
Huh. Now, was there any objections to folks finding out that they were on this list and challenging whether they should be on the list?
I think there was some objections about, and I'm hesitating because I don't want to say harassed, but I don't think there was objections about the attention that they were receiving from the police department.
Okay.
I would say it was rightfully so.
Let's move on. I want to talk now about the New York Association for Law Enforcement Analysts, because you're a founding member. So talk about this creation and how this association came to be.
It kind of came in two waves. The first wave was back in 2009, I think it was, where we wanted to stand something up. It was like Chris Delaney was one of the founding members of that version. I think we had some other people too that helped assist with that, Sheila Dorn. But that one kind of didn't get off the ground. I think maybe it was a financial kind of issue once we needed to pony up the money. But the second time it did get completed, I think the impetus from my point of view was that we get so much support from New York State. We're very, very fortunate. But it was kind of like a worst case scenario. What if, you know, the political wind changed and we didn't get as much support as we've had in the past? Where would we be? We'd be rocked back to the Stone Age in that type of way that we can socialize and share ideas. So it was definitely a function of creating redundancy in a worst case scenario.
So is this association, is it associated with the IECA or associated with ILEA or neither?
I think originally we wanted to be associated with both, but right now we do share membership with IACA.
Okay. And then what are some of the goals or events that you all are putting on?
Yeah, we've been in existence for about a year and a half, maybe not quite 2 years. So a lot of that's been under COVID, which has just been such a strange time. We're reinvesting in a couple different aspects, including a mentor program. We aligned with some other associations where we were lined up to do some speeches and some talks and some conferences, but they're few and far between right now. But I think just having an opportunity for us to share ideas through a membership meeting and extending the profession of where New York State crime analysis is in a public fashion is definitely important, as well as sharing job opportunities.
Okay. How many members do you have?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think we're around 30.
Okay.
A little more than 30.
And then what are some long-range goals?
I think a long-range goal would be to have our own conference or at least pair up with another association. I think that we want to fill more committees so that way we can have more tangible items. We're going to be putting out a newsletter this month. That's a new item. So I think there's going to be a lot of growth in the next couple of years. So looking forward to just seeing it grow bigger and bigger.
You mentioned MACA, Massachusetts, which I'm aware of. In terms of some of the neighboring states around New York, do any of them have their own regional association?
It's a good question. I don't think so. MACA is just really the biggest one. I think everybody kind of likes to latch onto that. No, none come to mind.
Is it just for people in New York, or if there's an analyst from Pennsylvania that wants to join the association, can they do so?
No, there's no residency requirement, and we are very open to, you know, not just crime analysts, but intelligence analysts. We have some professors as well. So it's a pretty rich community, sworn, non-sworn, because analysis is just not one thing. It's a lot of different things, and we kind of represent that.
All right. Well, let's talk about some personal interests now. And you have a unique hobby. At least I find it unique. Maybe you don't think it's unique, but I find it to be unique. You and your wife have a whole leaf tea business that you've been running for the last 9 years.
Yeah. I mean, the long story short is that my wife was raising our youngest child. She was about 1 year old. We have two others. And I was like, all right, well, what kind of career path do you think you want to go? She has a master's in early childhood education, but didn't really want to pursue that after having three of your own. Food is she has a fantastic palate. Food is certainly a passion. And so we tried to brainstorm. We kind of fell into tea by luck. We started blending teas and ordering teas. And we hit a couple craft fairs, farmers markets, and selling teas. And then lo and behold, we wound up with what we now call as a tea lounge. As I mentioned, she has a fantastic palate. So we do a lot of different kinds of drinks. Bubble teas made it form the business because in summertime, you know, not too many people drink hot tea or loose tea, although iced tea is a thing. But you kind of, once my wife says, oh, we could do bubble tea in the summertime, I was like, oh yeah, this is definitely a business model that we can hold on to. So my wife wanted to create Tea World. So we bake with tea. We have about 150 different kinds of loose teas now. I don't know, probably about just as many drinks as well.
And then this is whole leaf. And forgive my ignorance on tea, but when I'm thinking tea, you get the little packet and you're putting it in hot water and that's how you make tea. So, but you're talking right about the whole leaf. So how do you use the whole leaf to make tea?
Right. If all tea came in a tea bag, I wouldn't be in the tea industry. Okay. It wasn't it wasn't until I purchased, you know, whole leaf tea for my wife for an anniversary gift that started steeping and looking at the tea leaves. And I'm saying, well, this leaf doesn't look like this leaf. And this leaf, they say, is caffeine free. But so, you know, you started analyzing what this stuff is. It just really opened an entire world. Like, for instance, you know, we know about white tea and green tea and black tea and oolong, and they actually all come from the same tea plant. It's just after you pick the tea leaf and you let it oxidize and interact with the air, does it create green and black? Like green tea is 0% oxidized. Black tea is 100% oxidized. And that changes completely, you know, what that beverage is going to be like.
In New York, can you grow your own tea plant?
We had a few tea plants, but no, they're not going to be, you know, producing anything. And our tea plants died. So where coffee grows is kind of where tea grows. So
sure.
We have been to Japan and China, Hawaii and Thailand to visit tea plantations or tea farms.
Oh, nice. Did you say that you do recipes with the tea?
Oh, yeah. So a common way of cooking with tea is just taking like black tea and throwing it in a muffin. But it's crunchy. It's not very good. So we grind down our tea. So we have like a chai, which is a black tea, ginger, cinnamon, cardamom, and clove in a shortbread. There's matcha, which is stone ground green tea from Japan. It's already in a powder form. So that's easy to, you know, add to baking. So there's a whole lot that you can do with it for sure.
Okay. Do you have your own recipes?
Yeah, we got quite a few. No, I mean, 90% of what we sell is baked goods that are our own recipes. Yep.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to your business in the show notes then.
All right. Short and Stout Tea is going to get a spot.
Yes. And just to combine the last two ideas, if you ever do have a conference with the New York Association, you'll have to have tea time then in the afternoon.
I think so. Yep.
All right. Well, our last segment to the show is Words to the World. Matthew, this is where you can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
My words to the world would be practice technical critical thinking. Now, so many times in the past, I've had inexperienced people say, the database is broke. Rather than just say it's broke, you know, why don't you investigate, you know, what's working? You know, that could help determine the data hops that the disconnect could occur. You know, if you were to have a car, you wouldn't bring it into the dealer and say, hey, listen, my car's broke. You'd kind of do a little identification of where the problem is and do a little critical thinking and follow the steps to find that problem.
Well, I leave every guest with you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later.
Same to you.
But I do appreciate you being on the show, Matthew. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Much appreciated. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.